At the Oxford Everett Conference in July, I made a presentation on the on-again-off-again relationship between Hugh Everett and his thesis advisor, John Wheeler. 50 years ago, Wheeler supported the formalism of Everett's controversial theory, urging Niels Bohr to sign off on it. But he was dead set against the descriptive language that Everett used in his original dissertation, including images of splitting amoebas and bifurcating cannonballs. Consequently, the version published by Reviews of Modern Physics in July 1957 was greatly abridged at Wheeler's insistence. Until 1973, when Bryce DeWitt and Neil Graham published his original thesis as the Many Worlds Interpretation of Quantum Mechanics, Everett blamed the rejection of his theory on the unavailability of his full argument, as well as the psychological difficulty of accepting a branching self. So tonight, I'm going to talk a bit about Everett's struggle to get his theory accepted by a Harvard-based philosopher of science after the Copenhagen group dismissed it as, quote, theology. We will look at a different aspect of Everett's life, the military aspect, in which Wheeler also played an important role. And then we are going to hear excerpts from the only tape recording of Everett in existence. But first, I will tell you how I found the tape. A few years back, I was talking to Steve Schenker, who's a friend of mine and a professor of physics at Stanford. He suggested that as a writer, I might want to look into a quantum theory of multiple universes proposed by a guy named Hugh Everett in the 1950s. I was chortling when Steve told me that many respectable physicists actually believe that there are trillions of copies of themselves floating around somewhere. No way, said I. Way, said Steve, as he Googled Everett. Up popped a biographical sketch of Everett written by Eugene Shikowsky of Kostroma, Russia. Mr. Shikowsky publishes science texts in Russian, and I'm not going to swear that I'm pronouncing his name right. I'm going to say Shikowsky for the moment. He once edited a physics book by Yuri Lebedev that focused on Everett's theory. And he became obsessed with writing a biography of Everett, who had died of a heart attack in 1982 at the age of 51. During the 1990s, from his computer in Kostroma, which I understand is a very cold, dark place in the winter, Shikowsky trolled the internet for information about Everett. One day, he discovered the Everett archive at the Niels Bohr Library at the American Institute of Physics. In 1991, Everett's widow, Nancy, had boxed up a cross-section of her husband's papers and donated them to the Institute. An archivist copied the materials for Shikowsky, who used them as the foundation of the biographical sketch, which he published on Max Tegmark's website in 2002 after Ken Ford edited it. Upon reading the sketch, I too was hooked, and I got in touch with Shikowsky. In 2005, Shikowsky told me that he was going underground since, quote, bad boys had burned down part of his business. He emailed me compressed files of his research and expressed the hope that I would write a full-length biography. And that was the last time that either Ken Ford or I heard from Kostroma. I ended up duplicating and then going beyond Eugene's path-breaking research and discovered, as he had, that the sole surviving member of Everett's nuclear family was his son, Mark, who was a rock star based in Los Angeles. And Mark agreed to be interviewed for my story about his father that will appear in the December issue of Scientific American. One thing led to another, and in June this year, the BBC videoed Mark and I as we descended into his basement in Los Angeles and opened up boxes packed with his father's papers and effects. We found letters from folks like Niels Bohr, Norbert Wiener, and of course, Wheeler. We found the sheaves of yellow legal paper upon which Everett penciled his dissertation during his second year of graduate school. And we found an ancient dictaphone with a tape recording of Everett reminiscing about his college days 20 years after his abbreviated thesis was published. But the batteries were dead. Eventually, however, the BBC technicians furnished us with a CD of Everett's musings. Hugh Everett III was born in 1930 into a military family. Army Colonel Hugh Everett Jr. sent number 3 off to military school after divorcing his mother, Catherine Kennedy, in 1938. Catherine spent the rest of her life in and out of mental institutions. But she was a published poet who wrote about space, time and God. In one of Everett's boxes, we found a short story written by Hugh as a seventh grader and typed up by Catherine, The Bone of Muttsburg. It's about a war between cats and dogs. In it, the threat of mutually assured destruction between Catsville and Muttsburg reaches equilibrium through application of a rudimentary form of game theory by a wise if greedy king. Years later, as an undergraduate at Catholic University, Everett astonished his teachers with his grasp of mathematics and game theory. In 1953, he began studying graduate-level mathematical physics and quantum mechanics at Princeton with Eugene Wigner and Wheeler. At Oxford, I related how, over the course of his life, Wheeler was often of two minds about whether or not Everett's interpretation of quantum mechanics is true. It turns out, though, in several matters regarding Everett, Wheeler's mind frequently bifurcated. In May 1956, even as Wheeler was in Copenhagen unsuccessfully making his case for the relative state formulation to Niels Bohr, he wrote to Everett, who was about to take a job with the top secret weapons systems evaluation group at the Pentagon. Quote, in our discussions, I understand you prefer to go with the operations research group in the fall rather than take an academic position then, A, because of draft problems, B, because of a desire anyway to do your bit for national defense, C, because equipment in Washington would allow you to do some special projects you were interested in. I respect all three wishes, but feel that in the following year, you ought to start working toward a first-class academic position that will allow you to stand with full freedom for a cause and subject of your own. You have something original and important to contribute, and I feel you ought not to let yourself be distracted from it. Even though Wheeler, a veteran of the Manhattan Project, and along with Edward Teller, an architect of the hydrogen bomb, often recruited bright young men to work in national defense, he was uncertain about how to best shape Everett's career. He facilitated his star pupil's entry into top secret work with the military, but he also recommended Everett for academic positions at the University of Wisconsin and Boston University, which Everett declined. He suggested to General Atomic Corporation that Everett would be a good candidate to work on controlled fusion. He sent Everett a page torn from a trade publication about a young man who was working simultaneously as a professor of mathematics while doing revolutionary scientific work at Bell Labs. On the page, Wheeler wrote, quote, Hugh, hope you make a special position for yourself like this. And he drew an arrow to the man's name, Claude E. Shannon. Everett, of course, was well aware of Shannon's success. He had relied upon his information theoretics in constructing his thesis. But he came of military stock, and he wanted to live in the Washington, D.C. area where he grew up and where his family had roots. And he was an adept at game theory, which was all the rage inside the Pentagon. In fact, the same summer that his interpretation of quantum mechanics was published, Princeton University Press released Everett's important paper on recursive games. As a student, you see, Everett kept several intellectual irons in the fire of academia. In May 1957, after a year of battling unsuccessfully with Wheeler, Bohr, and others over the fate of his interpretation, Everett sent a copy of the abridged thesis to Professor Philip Frank, a philosopher of science at Harvard, who had edited a book called The Validation of Scientific Theories in 1954. Everett was in his book club. Everett wrote to Frank, quote, I have received several of your works on the philosophy of science. I have found them extremely stimulating and valuable. I find that you have expressed a viewpoint which is very nearly identical with the one I have developed independently over the last few years concerning the nature of physical reality. In his book, Frank included his own essay, The Variety of Reasons for the Acceptance of Scientific Theories, in which he examined the furor around Nicholas Copernicus, the 16th century scientist whose heliocentric theory was not recognized as true until Isaac Newton substantiated it a century after Copernicus died. As an example of scientific rigidity toward the counterintuitive, Frank cited Francis Bacon, who had rejected the Copernican view because it did not accord to common sense. Frank elaborated, quote, "Looking at the historical record, we notice that the requirement of compatibility with common sense and the rejection of, quote, unnatural theories have been advocated with a highly emotional undertone. And it is reasonable to raise the question, what was the source of heat in those fights against new and absurd theories? Surveying those battles, we easily find one common feature, the apprehension that a disagreement with common sense may deprive scientific theories of their value as incentives for a desirable human behavior. In other words, by becoming incompatible with common sense, scientific theories lose their fitness to support desirable attitudes in the domain of ethics, politics, and religion." When Bryce DeWitt first encountered Everett's theory as the editor of the journal in which it was printed in 1957, he found it attractive but impossible because he said, quote, "I simply do not branch." Everett replied that the same sort of objection was raised by Copernicus's critics. When he asserted that the Earth revolved around the sun, they said that that was impossible because they could not feel it move. Everett poked DeWitt, quote, "I can't resist asking, do you feel the motion of the Earth?" DeWitt later said that was a turning point for him, and he became Everett's champion. But simultaneous to the exchange with DeWitt, Everett was looking for support from Frank, based no doubt on Frank's use of Copernicus to highlight the battle between common and uncommon sensibilities. Everett wrote to Frank that he might be interested in his relative state dissertation, quote, "as an example of a certain kind of theory, a completely abstract mathematical model which is ultimately put into correspondence with experience. It has the interesting feature, however, that this correspondence can be made only by invoking the theory itself to predict our experience. The world picture presented by the basic mathematical theory being entirely alien to our usual conception of, quote, reality, one will only swallow the world picture implied by the theory if one has, I believe, if one will only swallow the world picture implied by the theory, one has, I believe, the simplest, most complete framework for the interpretation of quantum mechanics today." I do not know if Frank replied, but I do know that after Everett's published theory was loudly ignored by the physics establishment a few months later, Everett never published another word of quantum mechanics. When he visited Bohr in 1959 to talk with the great man about his theory, he spent his spare time drinking beer at the Hotel Osterport, as opposed to, for instance, hanging around the Institute for Theoretical Physics, schmoozing with Bohr's colleagues. One beery afternoon, he was inspired to write out on hotel stationery an important refinement of the other mathematical tour de force for which he is renowned, the generalized Lagrange multiplier method, also known as the Everett algorithm. That method, which Everett initially developed with his colleague George Pugh's input at the Weapons Systems Evaluation Group, simplifies searches for optimum solutions to complex logistical problems, ranging from the deployment of nuclear weapons to just-in-time industrial production schedules to the routing of buses for maximizing the desegregation of school districts. The method is reportedly still used by Pentagon war planners, and it became the foundation of Everett's livelihood. The Weapons Systems Evaluation Group, acronymed WESIG, was a project of the Institute for Defense Analyses, a nonprofit that was created by a consortium of universities in the early 1950s to do operations research directly for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Although WESIG was dissolved in 1976, the Institute for Defense Analyses is associated with the National Security Agency's program to develop quantum computers and is deeply involved in developing advanced weaponry for the Iraq War and has venture capitalists on its governing board. Upon joining WESIG in the summer of 1956, Everett met Pugh, a physicist hailing from MIT, who soon became his friend and later his business partner. Everett was quickly appointed head of WESIG's mathematics division. One of his first assignments was working with Pugh to develop models of radioactive fallout patterns. Their results revealed just how extraordinarily lethal a nuclear exchange would be. Everett also designed war games. He researched artificial intelligence and the use of automatic document editing computer programs by intelligence agencies, including the National Security Agency. And he was instrumental in designing, programming, and operating the military's fast-growing computer system. Clearly, the excitement and sheer fun of playing an important role in deciding the fate of the Earth at the age of 27 outweighed the prospect, in Everett's view, of spending his career muddling through debates with quantum theorists whom he considered to be hopeless dogmatists. A year after Everett joined Wessig, Wheeler dropped him a note saying that he had talked to General James McCormick, who, quote, said you were worth your weight in plutonium-239. And that you were one of the top people in the whole organization, in his view. However, I hope that Bob Sachs will succeed in luring you into quieter and more reflective areas at the University of Wisconsin, because I really think you have a lot of original things to give to the world, which you really can't do through the present setup. If you are hell-bent on staying in Washington at any price, why don't you let me see if George Washington University couldn't make a really attractive position for you? And, for the love of Mike, please wire or phone Bohr long distance and make a series of dates to chew on what you now have formally in print and what I hope you will soon further augment in print. 2 months later, Wheeler sent Everett a copy of his fervent recommendation to President Eisenhower that the government create, quote, a central missile or advanced planning laboratory, soon to be known as the Advanced Research Project Agency, or ARPA. Wheeler appended a personal note. Quote, dear Hugh, this is a copy of what I sent off after listening to a classified briefing on the terrifying lead the Russians have on us. I can't see any escape from our having to set up some such central advanced projects research lab. End quote. The problem with Wheeler's analysis or with his briefer's information was that the Russians did not have a lead. Quite the contrary, the so-called missile gap was the result of, to put it charitably, faulty intelligence. That, combined with Russia launching Sputnik in October 1957, sent Congress and the media into a tizzy, and the arms race was on. As Wessig scientists, Everett and Pugh, advised high-level officials in the Eisenhower and Kennedy administrations on defensive strategies, as well as methods for selecting hydrogen bomb targets and delivering optimal punch should war occur. Everett's work impacted the shape of the actual war plans known as single integrated operational plans, PSIOPs. In 1960, he was instrumental in creating Wessig number 50, a critical catalytic report on nuclear strategic posture, which remains classified to this day. Its title was Evaluation of Strategic Offensive Weapons Systems. According to historians, Wessig 50 debunked the existence of a missile gap and influenced the adoption of military strategies that remained operative for decades, including the doctrine of mutually assured destruction. Wessig 50's approach to preparing for nuclear war reportedly favored deploying land-based Minuteman missiles over expanding the bomber force. The 10-volume report lobbied for the development of the Polaris submarine as a deterrent. This mix of offensive weaponry, which could obviously launch first strikes, but it was considered to be capable of surviving a first strike and launching a massive deadly retaliation. In January 1961, Everett personally briefed incoming Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara on Wessig's cost-benefit analysis of nuclear warfighting options. These must have been interesting times for a young scientist who believed in the existence of all possible worlds. Pugh, who has written a memoir available at the American Institute of Physics, first noticed his friend's drinking problem in August 1957, when they shared a hotel room on a trip to Los Angeles to buy a computer for Wessig. Quote, as we were getting ready for bed, Everett opened his suitcase, pulled out a large bottle of bourbon whiskey, and asked if I would join him in a nightcap. I was amazed that he seemed so committed to the use of alcohol to go to sleep. It was, unfortunately, indicative of a debilitating addiction. In 1964, Pugh joined with Everett and five other Wessig colleagues, whom were in fact the intellectual cream of Wessig, to create a private company, Lambda Corporation of Arlington, Virginia. The brainy firm, with Everett as chairman of the board, obtained a series of lucrative contracts from their former colleagues at the Department of Defense. In Mark's basement, we found a Lambda paper on ballistic missile defense written by Everett for ARPA in 1967. It is entitled, "Some Mathematical Relations for Probability of Kill, Family of Damage Functions for Multiple Weapon Attacks." In the paper, the Everett algorithm underpins a method of calculating hypothetical kill payoffs and damages in a nuclear war. Lambda's bread and butter was devising computerized nuclear war games. The company wrote nuclear bomb targeting algorithms that were reportedly used by the military until the fall of the Soviet Union. And in 1971, Everett built a prototype Bayesian machine, a computer program which learns from experience and simplifies decision making by deducing probable outcomes, much like the human faculty of common sense. Under contract to the Pentagon, Lambda used the Bayesian method to research techniques for tracking trajectories of incoming ballistic missiles. The method can also be applied to evaluating policymaking decisions. During its few years of existence, Lambda's 50 employees consulted for the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, NATO, NORAD, the Central Intelligence Agency, National Security Agency, the Navy, Army, Air Force, and Merck Corporation, for which it invented an optimizing method for the manufacture of pharmaceuticals. Under Pugh's supervision, Lambda created a method based, you guessed it, on the Everett algorithm for solving the seemingly intractable problem of designing bus routes to desegregate schools in 45 urban areas. Lambda also developed rapid response models for evaluation of strategic force postures. It researched anti-submarine warfare issues and created models for the optimal allocation of blast shelters. It wrote plans for conducting national damage assessments in the event that the unthinkable was thought. Statistician and national security consultant Joseph George Caldwell, who worked with Everett at Lambda, remembered, quote, "Everett really enjoyed solving difficult problems in poker. He drove a long black 1964 Lincoln Continental and enjoyed eating in fine restaurants. He smoked his cigarettes with a filter, had long swept back black hair and a mustache goatee, which he stroked while reviewing his poker hands." But, Caldwell continued, "if you think that Everett's generalized Lagrange multipliers are not important to you, to your life, consider this. Everett's multipliers are the theoretical basis for determining which cities are defended by anti-missile defenses. If global nuclear war breaks out, it is Everett's theory that will determine whether your city is targeted or defended and whether you live or die." By the early 1970s, Lambda was in trouble. The winding down of the war in Vietnam, the prospect of nuclear disarmament, and economic shocks resulted in Defense Department cutbacks in consulting budgets. A worried Lambda executive observed, quote, "We seem to me like a steamship halted at sea, slowly drifting onto a reef. At first reluctantly, but eventually gaily, we begin to throw overboard the brass fittings, the cargo, and finally the crew, while hoping to float over the frightening coral." To shorten the story, Lambda sank, probably due to mismanagement. In 1973, Everett and Donald Reisler, a Lambda alumni, started a data processing company called DBS. Reisler, a physicist, administered the business, freeing Everett up to concentrate on the technical end. Reisler says that when they first met, Everett asked him if he had ever read his paper on relative states. Quote, "I thought for an instant and replied, oh my God, you are that Everett. The crazy one who wrote that in the same paper. I had read it in graduate school and chuckled and rejected it out of hand." They agreed to not talk about multiple universes and became close friends. DBS Corporation held a variety of federal contracts, including researching various weapons applications in analyzing the socioeconomic effects of government affirmative action programs. According to Reisler, his partner often enjoyed a three-martini lunch, sleeping it off in his office. But he was still productive, still a genius at solving complex problems, when he wasn't sailing off on Caribbean cruises or vacationing in his condo on St. Thomas Island or flying TWA first class to San Francisco for business pursuits and Epicurean pleasures. Everett was well paid by DBS. He owned a small travel agency and a voice recognition software startup. But he did not have the discipline to become really wealthy. Quote, he wanted to make money. He liked money. He liked nice things. He was just unwilling to devote himself to it, Reisler remarks. Barely a millionaire, Everett liked to have his definition of a good time, which at home anyway meant chain smoking, snacking on raw hamburger, playing with his $25,000 Radio Shack TRS-80 home computer, and writing reams of computer code late into the night while ingesting martinis. Reisler reflects, quote, the task of having children overwhelmed Hugh. He was not a sympathetic person. He brought a cold, brutal logic to the study of things. Civil rights entitlements made no sense to him. He was a problem solver and a hedonist. Inside the wave function describing Hugh Everett are contained intimate explanatory details of his life, or perhaps his many lives. In at least one Evertian branch, he is perhaps sober, happy, and revered by physicists, philosophers, and the populace alike for the major contributions he made to quantum mechanics, probability theory, and political economy after his doctoral thesis rocked the world 50 years ago. But the laws of probability tell us that most of Everett's universes, if there is more than one, are similar to the one he no longer inhabits. And in the common branches of his personal multiverse, he and his family lived for many years in an expensive house in McLean, Virginia that sported a tiny indoor swimming pool. Quote, it was so humid it steamed up all the windows, Charles Misner told me. His wife, Suzanne, added, it was a household where you had the New York Times for several months lying on the floor. There was no discipline. There was no order. And in one of our conversations, Mark Everett said, quote, my parents had a kooky idea about raising children, the same way my father's parents raised him, the sink or swim theory. It's all backward. A kid needs a foundation to stand on, and we never really got that. Mark remembers his father, quote, always sitting at the dining room table, scribbling on yellow legal pads what looked to me like gibberish, pages and pages of it. He smoked three packs of cigarettes a day. He was overweight. He didn't exercise and was doctrophobic. He was certainly an alcoholic. Mark sighs. You are telling me more than I ever knew about my father. I was not aware that the lump of furniture sitting at the dining room table had a cigarette in one hand and the fate of the world in the other. I think he had moments of happiness, but I have a feeling he was depressed over not getting the recognition he deserved. Elizabeth Everett, Mark's older sister, who would have been 50 last July, made the first of many suicide attempts in mid-June of 1982. Mark discovered his sister unconscious on the bathroom floor and got her to the hospital just as her heart stopped. She survived. When Mark returned home later that night, Hugh, quote, looked up from his newspaper and said, I didn't know she was that sad. 1 month later, Mark found his father dead in bed of a massive heart attack. Feeling the cold body, he realized that he had no memory of ever touching his dad. In 1996, Elizabeth succeeded in killing herself with an overdose of sleeping pills in Oahu, Hawaii, leaving behind a note saying she was going to join her father in another universe. Nancy Everett, a non-smoker, died of lung cancer 2 years later on Hugh's birthday with Mark at her bedside. The last Everett standing observes, quote, no matter how hard you try not to be like your parents, one day you wake up and you go to brush your teeth and you look up in the mirror and you see your father all of a sudden, And then you start to identify with them. I was always working on ideas inside my head, so I started to understand why children could be a problem. You're just about to crack the code, and they want to play baseball. In 2005, Mark released a song called Things the Grandchildren Should Know. In it, he finally forgives his father. I never really understood what it must have been like for him living inside his head. Hugh Everett might have understood his son's song. In the original version of his thesis, he concluded, quote, "Once we have granted that any physical theory is essentially only a model for the world of experience, we must renounce all hope of finding anything like the correct theory, simply because the totality of experience is never accessible to us." Some of it is. After a few drinks in 1977, so you can turn the screen on now if you like, Everett and Charles Misner reminisced on tape about their college days and the development of Everett's strange idea. The drumming you hear at the end is Mark, age 13, pounding away in another room. So allow me to turn on my computer and we'll hear Hugh, and I threw a couple of slides up there too for you.
When the man starts to sing here.
Okay.
Weird quantum mechanics. Oh, it was because of you and Owen Peterson one night.
Want to turn it up then, Jim?
Testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
All right.
Down here.
Okay.
Drink for us.
Well, it's been a great evening. I enjoyed spending our 18th anniversary with you, Hugh. Why don't you lead on after your drink by telling us how you got started with John Wheeler?
Well, I got started.
Whatever made you decide to pick him for a thesis advisor?
Well, actually, I didn't. Somebody assigned him to me, and I needed one to get my fellowship renewed.
I see. Right. So it was all bureaucracy.
That's correct. My first year was actually spent in the mathematics department.
And when did you get on to weird quantum mechanics?
Well, it was because of you and Ella Peterson one night at the graduate college after a slosh or two of sherry, if you might recall. You and Ella were starting to say some ridiculous things about the implications of quantum mechanics. And I was having a little fun joshing you and telling you some of the outrageous implications of what you said. As we had a little more sherry and got a little farther into conversation. Don't you remember, Charlie? You were there.
I don't remember that evening, actually, but I do
you
remember
when
Sherry Peterson was around. That's entirely possible.
You had too much sherry, that's
yeah. Awesome. Was that after I was starting on the Range theory, which we didn't know was the Range theory at that time, because...
Oh, I remember that.
Remember that?
Yes, I remember. That was that same
year. You read his book and told us, look, this is a great idea. Why? How did he work that out? Because he certainly had great respect for Bohr.
Oh, yes.
But he's always intrigued by an imaginative idea.
Mm-hmm.
So he was partly trying to get you and Bohr to agree.
Yes, I spent 6 weeks, as you know, you were there, yes. Yeah. And, yeah, and that was a whole doomed from the beginning.
Right. You sat trying to talk to Gorbachev.
Well, he refought the battles of 1925 or something.
He didn't get a chance to say something, and he would relight his pipe 17 times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, it's marvelous to even make that attempt. I don't know how old he was at the time.
Oh, yeah, no, there isn't.
60 years old.
Well, you know what really came out of that trip to Copenhagen was the invention of the Lagrange multiplier.
For what?
No reason. It's not relevant to physics. Why? It was out of the record. That was a truly great accomplishment of that Copenhagen trip, though. Made Lambert Corporation.
Now, which year was that? Was that?
I believe. That was the 6 week. That was 15. Now you tell me.
I never got
any of this largesse that I know of.
Well, maybe he figured your father was too rich.
My father? He's an army colonel.
But the suspicion gradually dawned on most graduate students that the friends consisted primarily of John.
Oh, really?
No.
Huh. He was. Well, I didn't know him back then.
Yeah, he was preaching this idea that you ought to just look at the equations and the fundamentals of physics while you follow their conclusions and better give them a serious hearing. He was doing that on these solutions of Einstein's equations like wormholes and geons.
Oh, I got to admit that is right. It might very well have been totally instrumental in what I...
Encouraging you to follow up your own ideas on this. Yeah. Obviously ridiculous argument that was only intended to shut up obstreperous friends like me and Peterson.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I can't think I ever had very many serious thoughts about basic quantum mechanics, but of course, Peterson.
Yeah, none of us really took it very, none of us really took it seriously, except for all of them.
Oh, actually, it was a very strange experience. I don't know whether you went through it, but I certainly did, as an undergraduate, getting taught by people who were learning quantum mechanics in the 30s.
Yeah.
And to them, quantum mechanics was really a big philosophical change, and they were shocked by the whole ideas and so forth.
Yeah.
And somehow we were...
Didn't seem all that funny,
Felt that, well, you know, every new course in physics, you get some new kind of nonsense, and it seems to make sense.
Yeah.
A little bit later, so quantum mechanics is no worse than electromagnetic fields or F equals MA or whatever it might be.
Yeah, electromagnetism is still mysterious. Oh, goodness, I don't know.
But how did John pick you up? I mean, you had these ideas that stirred up in general conversation. You began to work out more of the detailed mathematics of it. Where did John begin to play a role in the whole affair? Did you have a whole thesis written before you talked to him?
No. No. Yeah, I guess.
Are you going to
vote for him? Yeah, there you are. No, he didn't play a role. It's coming back now. You know, I said there's obviously something wrong here. I showed the paradoxes and whatnot, and something should be done to change it. And he did keep saying why. You know, why not? So he did his ultimate conservatism, as he put it, kept coming through. You know, why? Why?
Well,
he kept doing funny little experiments with balls running down inclined slopes or something.
question. That was quite not the gist of what they were, but. I can't put my finger on it.
That was me, his main influence, well, one of, at least a very important influence, was to always point out possible problems and solutions that were so far-fetched that you felt you had to put Johnny on the straight and narrow track and sort of calculate something and show him how this was really done. You know? He was always off on this wild blue yonder that was stretching your imagination and not allowing you to ever do any mundane problems. But you evidently might have had a chance of being one ahead of him on this kind of stuff. Did he have the same attitude towards you? I mean, did he try to make you think more exotically, or was he helping you focus down towards the real tests of the questions?
Well, I don't know what to say about that.
In any interaction, both sides focus.
End of this tape.
Roy / Gary / Dorothy. 6 work measurement. Roy /
That's it. I'll entertain any questions if anybody wants. But. Yes. I'll be happy to give it to you.
Is the transcript going to be in George Pugh's book that he's putting together?
I have no idea. The transcript is actually was first done by his wife and is in the American Institute of Physics archives. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, even as late as 1977, Wheeler and DeWitt invited him to go to Austin to talk about his theory, which he did. David Deutsch was there. And after he came home, Wheeler tried to get him to go to the Institute at Santa Barbara. He set up an invitation, basically, for him to go there, but he didn't want to. By that time, his work was pretty dull stuff, and he was pretty far into his alcoholic disease, he just was kind of immovable, you know.
Did he ever say why? Did he ever write a letter to Wheeler saying thank you very much for
Well, you might remember at the Oxford thing, I quoted from a letter that he and Nancy had written. In I think right a month after the Austin trip, and there was a lot of ill feeling there. There was a lot of bitterness, and it's a funny thing how reality comes up. I mean, Wheeler really was his champion, you know, and at a certain point he cut his losses, and who wouldn't, frankly, you know, given his position. But he never like turned his back on Everett. You know, he was there for him. You know. But Everett didn't feel that way, I don't think. I think he felt that Wheeler had turned his back on him. And that stems primarily from he, I believe, really blamed Wheeler for making him abridge the dissertation to the extent that the world of physics did not comprehend his full argument. And in fact, 75% of it was cut, including a chapter on probability and information theory. And it was reformulated as a theory of quantizing general relativity, which was not Everett's project, but was Wheeler's project. He advocated the theory. I mean, he wrote in the published version of the theory a companion piece comparing Everett to Newton, Maxwell, and Einstein. And this was after the theory was abridged to his liking, and after it was reformulated as a theory of you know, quantizing general relativity. But I think that Wheeler was a very loyal person, you know. And Everett was not blameless. If he really wanted to do quantum mechanics, he could have. Every opportunity was given to him. And for reasons of his own, he wanted to live his life the way he did. You know, so it would be grossly unfair to blame Wheeler for what happened. I mean, you know, he did what he had to do, I suppose. On the other hand, was it correct to make him edit his dissertation to the extent that he did? I mean, he basically told him, I will not give you your degree unless you edit it the way I want you to edit it. That's the question for history, isn't it? It was called that. It was called that, and then Wheeler put the kibosh on that very strongly. There's a lot of letters from Everett to Wheeler. I quoted some in this presentation and the other one too, but I mean, there's more. I mean, Wheeler corresponded vociferously, or you know, he wrote a lot to people. His collected letters would probably be a ton, you know. And he was a great facilitator of people meeting people. And he really did mentor Everett. And, you know, I think maybe I'm not going to psychoanalyze John Wheeler, but, you know, he might have even felt a little bit guilty about facilitating his entree into the defense work, because that consumed him and sucked him up and took him away from quantum mechanics. And I think that Wheeler genuinely felt that he had more to contribute to quantum mechanics than he did to the nuclear war plans. Yeah. Who felt guilty, Wheeler or Everett? You mean guilty because he was planning nuclear wars that he believed were happening in many branches of the multiverse? His friends described him his evolution of his own philosophical outlook, and also I can substantiate it from some of his writings. I think he started out as kind of a libertarian, you know, type focus, and a lot of his friends say he was very active promoter of solipsism, that he liked to tease people by saying that, and this is very odd, isn't it, coming from him, that they existed only because he had thought of them, and that if he wanted to put them out of existence, he would unthink them. Very odd coming from him. But even odder is the two copies of the Marquis de Sade's 130 Days in Sodom that I found in one of the boxes, very well thumbed. I can't say that I read the books, but I did go to Wikipedia to find a description of what's in them, and the philosophy of the Marquis and what Hugh was expressing towards the end of his life were quite similar, not sexually, but actually politically, because the Marquis had apparently a worked out point of view. And he was, according to his friends, a liberal Democrat who I think ended up voting for Reagan, whatever that means. And he was intrigued by the Army-McCarthy hearings. He loved watching that on TV, skipped class to do it. Same thing with Watergate. He thought that was just fun, fun, fun. He wasn't a nice person, you know, by anybody's account. His son probably is feeling a little more bitter than his business friends, who saw him in a different way, you know. I hear that tape. I hear a pretty intelligent guy that's just kind of trapped. You know, I mean, I know a lot about him, but I feel that he kind of left himself with very few options in the world. You know, he cut people out, and he was kind of cynical, At the same time, he did have this great verve. I mean, he really wanted to live, and he really wanted to do things. And according to Nancy, she left a little scribble on a piece of paper when she was preparing his funeral service. He thought that God, he didn't believe in God, but he thought that God had given people a raw deal. And best you could do was to get yours, basically, and not to hurt people if you could help it, you know. So, to answer your question, I asked Don Reisler that very same question, and that's when Don said to me what I quoted there, which he had a cold, brutal logic, that he was solipsistic at that time. And I think, like many Cold War technocrats of that type, which is a very definite type of person that emerged out of the 1950s and out of physics, probably, he decided that he wouldn't think about those things. You know? Which is not to say he didn't think about them, because how could he have helped but not thought about it, given where he was coming from? So when Mark first saw, when the BBC was making this film this summer, he first saw the sign for Psi. He looked at it and he said, "What's that little devil's pitchfork?" That's the title of my book. The Devil's Pitchfork, Multiple Universes, Mutually Assured Destruction, and the Meltdown of a Nuclear Family. He didn't have one. No, he didn't. He liked CB radios. For one summer, he hung out with a bunch of redneck beer-drinking truck drivers with CBs and had barbecues in the back patio until he got tired of doing that. He watched John Wheeler on television and got really drunk doing it and wrote letters that he never sent. He didn't go to the theater. He didn't read, as far as I know, fiction. The books that I found that he looks like he was reading before he died, he had John Bell's first paper that talked about Everett in not very glowing terms, and Everett had made comments on it, breaking his pencil lead in the process. He was so pissed off. He liked Paul Davies' book, the Other World books, and it marked in there where his name appeared in the index and then put a post-it where the bit about his stuff was. There was a book, The Dancing Wu-Wee Masters or something, some spiritual quantum thing, and he had marked that where it talked about the Everett interpretation and marked the index. Like many people, I think that when he went into a bookstore, he looked at the indexes first before he bought the book. Clearly cared about it. I related this at Oxford, but I'll relate it again. One thing I found in his effects was a questionnaire that had been sent to him by, I think, the National Science Foundation, asking for, you know, it had like 300 or 400 specialties. What are your 5 top specialties? And he listed it in reverse order. I think 5 was like decision theory or cybernetics or something, and then 2 was like general relativity, and 1 was quantum mechanics. So after all those years and all disappointment, he still considered himself to be a quantum mechanical person.
Did you find much Yama's book?
No, I didn't. I haven't seen everything that's there yet. But I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't have it. Mm. You know?
Yama's book.
I did, however, find the correspondence between him and Yammer. Yeah, I actually referenced in that other talk a little bit when he was put in the... Yammer apparently had never heard about Everett and his theory until he talked to Bryce DeWitt when he was doing the book, and it was towards the end of his research, and DeWitt told him about it, and he went, "Oh, I better put this guy in my book," and so he wrote a letter to Everett, and Everett responded in great detail, and when Yammer wrote his book, of course, which I believe ends pretty much the philosophy of quantum mechanics, a bit on Everett there. He referenced that letter as his main source. And that letter pretty much lays it out, as I've described, in terms of how he thought about his theory, who his influences were. You know, Misner really was an influence on him, and so was Og Petersen. And obviously Bohr was, but I don't think he was real keen on giving Bohr. I mean, obviously Wheeler was. He wasn't real keen on giving Wheeler too much credit if he could get away with it. But revealingly in that and other correspondence through the 70s, when asked if he believed his own theory, he always said, with one exception, he said yes, you know. And at the same time, some of his friends think that he didn't care. Some of his friends would say, well, nah, all he cared about was having a good time and making money, and he didn't care about his theory. Well, they didn't know him, because he did. Some guy wrote him, some scientist from Europe or something, wanting a reprint, you know, 15 years later, and asked him if he done any more work in it, and he said, no, I gave the manuscript to Bryce DeWitt under the condition that I didn't have to even look at it, and I haven't thought about it since. Well, he was sitting at his dining room table, like whatever state he was in. I have scans of it. There's still more work to do. There's still 70 years of family correspondence. These people kept everything. I shared with Simon at one point, you know, Everett was supposed to have he was notorious among his circle for, when he went to Catholic University, for using the predicate logic to disprove the existence of God. And apparently it upset one of his professors so much that the professor lost his faith and despaired. And according to Reisler and others, Hugh vowed never to do that again to anybody. But in a cigar box full of crummy porn and hotel tickets and other things, I found a scrap of paper with this predicate logic that related to the ontological argument, which I sent to Simon. Yeah. You have it?
Oh, come for a minute. I think I can remember what
it was. So Simon explained it to me. But I had the sense to send it to him. And he'd just written it out on a little post-it and thrown it into, like, the kibble box, you know? I said it was an improvement. His improvement on it, so he could disprove it, probably.
That's
a lot of sense, huh?
You want to know what's wrong with it?
But you get the idea. I mean, there he was, you know, scribbling these things on post-its and tossing them aside. And by all accounts, including his son and his own, he was a confirmed atheist, so he wasn't sitting around actually wondering if God existed.
No more questions.